there and welcome to The Forum, a podcast by staff. This episode sees us talking poverty. We spent some time in conversation with staff CEO Joe Derrick and Aberlour CEO Sally Ann Kelly. Sally Ann is also the chair of the staff board. There aren't any official figures on poverty amongst care leavers. However, the Independent Care Review commissioned some research which found that care experienced adults are over 1.5 times more likely to have financial difficulties and over 1.5 times more likely to experience severe multiple disadvantage. We know that experiencing poverty is a major contributory factor in care leavers not achieving their full potential. Care experienced young people are more likely to experience homelessness than their peers. They are 1.5 times more likely to have an anxiety at 16. And care experienced adults are almost twice as likely to have no internet at home. And we also know that children living in the 10% most deprived areas of Scotland are 20 times more likely to become care experienced than those in the 10% least deprived areas. Over the last year, we've been working with young people around some of these issues, and they've told us that care leavers often don't have an adequate income and have to jump through too many hoops to get money they're entitled to. Our discussion with Joe and Sally Ann teases out some of these issues.
Well, hello, Sally Ann, and thank you for joining us today where we're going to be talking about poverty. I've got a number of questions to ask you. We are well known about having views around poverty, but for those that might not know, would you give yourself a bit of an introduction, please, and tell us a bit about your interest in the area of poverty and how that's come about?
Okay, thanks, Jo. My name is Sally Ann Kelly. I'm the chair of staff. And in my day job, I'm the chief executive at Aberlour. I suppose my interest in poverty has always been there. Frankly, I was brought up in West Lothian in a wee mining village. Nobody in the mining village was very affluent, very rich. But, you know, you could see the impact of poverty all around you. When I left school and went to university, I was very interested in social issues, justice, fairness, all of that. So studied politics and economic history at university before embarking on a career in social work because I thought I was going to change the world as a social worker. Probably like lots of other social workers out there. I suppose I've always, throughout my social work career, had an interest in working with children and families and people who experience the justice system. And I've always tried to work in a way which is about trying to encourage folk to be involved in the decisions that are made in relation to their lives and what happens to them. And I suppose what I've also seen, you know, as an adult and as a child, was the negative impact that, you know, chronic poverty and the associated stress that brings has on families and children. And that burning desire to actually improve the lives of children and families and to eradicate poverty has never actually left me in the last 40 years. So, yeah, that's my background. I'm delighted to be able to lead an organisation that understands poverty, understands its impact, and understands that judgment has no place in terms of how we actually try to improve situations for families across the country.
Thank you, Sally Ann. That's really interesting. And as our chair, there's bits of that I didn't know beforehand. So it's amazing what we can learn about each other. And you talked a bit there about impact. And I don't think anyone can have a conversation at the moment without there being that through that lens around the pandemic. So could you tell us a bit more about how that pandemic has impacted, particularly about children, young people and families that Aberlour supports, please?
Yeah, so Aberlour supports a diverse range of children and families. And I suppose the first thing I would say is that families will have been impacted differently depending on their situation and their circumstances. But there are some common themes. The fact that schools had to close and early learning had to close for significant periods during the lockdown did have an impact on children and their families. I have to say that for some of the children that we have in our children's houses, they actually took the time to work with the adults who work alongside them to get engaged in education in quite a different kind of way, actually. And some of them have reported to us that they really enjoyed that, not having to be in that big classroom setting. But actually, for a lot of our children, being away from school has had a real impact, not just on their learning, but on the fact that they've not been able to be with their pals. You know, that some of those relationships have been affected. The most obvious thing for families as well is the economic and the financial burden that the pandemic has brought on them. So we were already working alongside and supporting families who were either living in poverty or just on the very edges of poverty, maybe in jobs where they paid the minimum wage. And when families experienced furlough, for example, or were laid off, they immediately went into real financial crisis. And that was a massive issue for a lot of the families that we work with. So there was those families who had been living in chronic poverty for many years, who were further disadvantaged because of the closure of schools and the various different impacts of lockdown. And then there was those families that had been just about managing, actually, financially, who were thrown into immediate crisis because they were on furlough or because they were made redundant or laid off. So one of the things we've noticed is a real increase in the number of families that we were already working with who were in need of immediate financial help. But because we run an urgent assistance fund, which is open to every family in Scotland who may be encountering a crisis in terms of their situations, we've also seen families across Scotland coming to us in a huge increase. I think in the first 3 months of the pandemic, we saw a 1,400% increase in the number of families asking for financial help. And we've actually worked really, really hard to bring more money to our urgent assistance fund. Usually we spend between £50,000 and £70,000 a year on the fund. We did a massive fundraising effort because we knew that families were going to need support. And I think by the end of the financial year, at the end of March, we probably will have brought in excess of £1 million to that fund. And that will be basically money that's come into Aberlour that we've been able to pay directly back to families, because our approach is to give families cash so that they can make their own decisions about what they need to spend that money on and where they want to spend that money, because we fundamentally believe that families make the best decisions and the best choices for themselves and their children.
Sally Ann, you've referred there to some of the impact that's been around for families before the pandemic. So I suppose recognising that the pandemic in its sense has just shed a new light on poverty that was already there. Anything from just thinking around that and the urgent assistance fund and that significant increase, any lessons learned from this experience that you can think of that you would want to share?
I think one of the most obvious ones is the need for us as a society to take a cash first approach. The fact is that families make the best decisions for families. Those decisions, the further they are away from families, the less likely they are to be good decisions. So there is something about how we actually knit that into our public services and to organisations that are there to support families to provide cash. I think the other thing for us is we did an evaluation of our urgent assistance fund, and there was a number of issues came up for us in terms of learning. One of them was that there are funds in place, Scottish Welfare Fund, for example, that not enough people know about. And those who do know about it either find it hard to access it or don't know how to access it. So they're losing out on potential entitlements to money. So there's something about how we as a country communicate access to emergency assistance for families in their broadest sense. So that's something that we need to think about. I think the other thing for me that surprised me when we looked at the activity around the Urgent Assistance Fund was that well over 50% of the families who received assistance were actually referred to us by the councils or the health boards. And it seems to me odd that those councils and those health boards don't have something in place locally to help families in very practical ways. And if they don't, then that's something they really need to think about, because what we do know is that when families get that early support when they're in crisis, it can be hugely beneficial to that family and can stop them becoming more reliant or entering into different crises within their families and relying more even more heavily on specialist supports. So there's something there, you know, that councils really need to take on board and health boards really need to take on board in terms of how they actually practically reach out and support families at the earliest possible time.
Thanks, Ali-Anne. And that's really interesting to think about how this matter has been responded to at a local level. We know that there's been, in recent years, there has been the renewed focus around child poverty from the Scottish Government. Just thinking about where we've said, you know, there's some challenges locally. There's been the introduction of statutory targets, there's plans around the Scottish child payment. So I suppose the question is there is, do you think there's enough being done?
I've been very honest in my public response to questions about whether there's enough being done. The short and simple answer for me is no. Child poverty figures are still going in the wrong direction. I think that you're right, the Scottish Government has put a focus on child poverty. There have been a number of, you know, initiatives, including Best Start grants and the newly introduced Scottish Child Payment that have been helpful. But the actual fact is, it's not enough. It's not enough. We are not going to reach our child poverty targets unless we do something more fundamental. So one of the things that the Child Poverty and Child Poverty Campaign is asking for is a doubling of the Scottish Child Payments to families, to take it from £10 to at least £20 a week for each child in the family, not just the youngest children and families, because we think that will make a big difference. I think that there is a real need for us as a country to properly embrace that families need support, financial support, on an ongoing basis. We're talking about one in four children living in poverty. Of the children who live in poverty just now, we can expect upwards of two-thirds of them to be living in families where parents are working, but they're working in low-paid jobs. And we need to do something about that in terms of the economy and making sure that work actually does pay for families and does lift them out of poverty. I think we also need to think about how we support our families that are in most need. One of the things that we've asked for, and the government has been doing some work on family support in its broadest sense, and has got a really ambitious paper in place, but at this stage it's no better than a paper about what we're going to do around supporting families. And what we've asked is that the government understands that financial adequacy and income adequacy is a central part of family support, because the consequences of living in long-term poverty and the associated toxic stress becomes an accelerator to children experiencing negative things happening in their life. They're more likely to struggle at school, they're more likely to have poor health, they're more likely to have compromised mental health. There's a whole host of things that can potentially happen there. So we need to look at money as part of that whole family support offer. But we also need to understand that the most powerful influencers in children's lives are their carers and their parents. And therefore, that family support offer needs to give a direct hand, link, support to the parent. And too many of our initiatives that we label, say, are about supporting families, are in-school approaches, which will be helpful to an extent, but they won't fundamentally address a poverty-related attainment gap, and they won't fundamentally address the stress and the issues and adversities and, at times, the trauma that is happening for children in the context of their family if they don't actually touch the family and don't encourage the family to engage in a long-term, positive, therapeutic relationship with somebody that they trust.
Thanks, Ali-Anne. That's really, really powerful message really important for us to be able to continue to reflect on. I think there's also something in here as I turn our conversation towards the experience that we've had as staff as an organisation, thinking about where the promise sits and some of the messages clearly around the promise around poverty and the implications of poverty when it comes to our care system and about young people and children and young people within that care system. I just wanted to acknowledge that within staff, one of the areas that we have been driving and now just now has been about economic well-being of care leavers. Yeah. The pandemic itself has had a significant impact on those who are in the process of transitioning or who have transitioned into being a care leaver. So I suppose just bringing the conversation and the question around to that area of thought, do you think enough is being done to support care leavers who are at risk or are already living in poverty?
My answer to this, my straightforward answer to this is similar to the last question. No, not enough is being done. And I'm hugely frustrated about this, to be honest. You know, we have got some of the most progressive, best legislation in the world in relation to people who are experiencing state care, if you like, care leavers. The fact is, we haven't properly implemented what we've been expected to implement in law. And we haven't put the money towards implementing that. And frankly, it's too easy to pass a law that is then thereafter not properly scrutinised and not properly implemented and not properly funded and still talk about the law. The law is only as powerful as its implementation, and it's simply not been implemented fully. And I feel for local authorities because they've not been funded properly around kids leaving care. And again, there is something fundamental. The promise speaks eloquently about this, and the children, families and young folk who contributed to the promise speak eloquently about this. You know, there is something for me about if you know, and we look after children in children's houses in Aberlour. And I've seen children who have left the care system and succeeded and thrived, but I've also seen too many children who have had poorer outcomes. And we know that children and young folk leaving care are more likely to end up homeless. They're more likely to have enduring mental health issues. They're more likely to end up in prison. They're more likely to have negative outcomes. And one of the things that I think we need to pay huge amount of attention to is what support we put in place for children, what we guarantee to our children and young people in our role as the, for some of them, you know, the only adult carers they know, and how long that should be provided. So one of the things that I want to look at and what and staff want to look at and Aberlour want to look at is testing the whole notion of a guaranteed income for kids who are leaving care. Now, that's not to say that moving on to university and college and getting a job isn't important. Of course, that's important. But actually, in addition to that, we should offer our children an income guarantee, which means regardless of where they end up, either in the university or college systems or in a full-time job, and we need to be pushing for all of those things too, they will have a minimum income that they know that they can rely on so that they're not faced with homelessness because they'll have enough money to pay rent if they need to pay rent, so that they won't need to worry about how they're going to feed themselves, how they're going to keep the lights on, how they're going to keep the gas on, because actually they'll have a guaranteed income, which means that they'll be able to pay for those things as in the same way that other young folk can. And that income will come from, you know, the state, the parents, I hate the expression corporate parents, but the state in their role as a parent and caregiver to that child or that young person over the last number of years. And I want us to test that. And I just want us to say, we're going to be brave enough as a nation to say that maybe just maybe offering these kids up to the age of 25, up to the age of 30, because of all of what we know about the potential for them to experience poor outcomes, and how much poverty impacts on those outcomes, that we're going to provide this to young folk to see if it makes a quality difference to their lives and to their mental health. Because whilst kids are homeless or living in unsafe living conditions, how can we possibly expect them to really focus in on healing from fractured relationships that they might have experienced over a number of years, you know, abuse that they may have encountered through their life, or any other negative or traumatic experiences. So alongside that guaranteed income, you will allow people the emotional space to get alongside, again, somebody that they can work with, develop a really trusting and trusted relationship with, to also give them the space that they need to emotionally grow and heal. And years that are really important, that period between 18 and 30 is an incredibly important time in terms of human development. And we need to give them the time and the space to heal and grow as young adults.
Thanks, Ali-Anne. I think that they speak so eloquently to the outcomes, the benefits beyond that of the actual pounds and pennies, which is really important as well. We've had some young people that, and caregivers that we've been speaking to, as you know, between Aberlour and staff, and where they have been expressing some scepticism around some form of a basic income, is that it would genuinely have no conditions, and it would be paid out automatically, and that it wouldn't just be an amalgamation of, well, if you have this one, it comes off of a benefit of somewhere else, for example. Although that is pounds and pennies, that's the kind of thing that we're having that conversation around just now. Do you share these concerns, or do you have any further thoughts around those concerns?
You know, I think it's really sad that young people feel that, but it doesn't surprise me. Because actually, I think if I had experienced some of the experiences that our young folk have experienced, I would feel sceptical that somebody could do something that was unconditionally good. And there lies the problem. But actually, as a country, we need to step up to the plate, and we need to offer unconditional guarantees to our young people in a way that we've never done before. So I'm not surprised that they're sceptical about it. Makes me quite sad, to be honest. You know, we're talking about a very small number of young people in our whole population that this would apply to. It cannot be beyond our wit to put our, you know, arms as a nation around those young folk and create safety, to create certainty, and to create an overwhelming feeling of love and value for those young folk. And that, for me, is what we need to do to address scepticism. We need to literally put our money where our mouths are and actually come through with this for our children and young folk.
Thanks, Ali-Anne. And again, just in reference to the actual amount of money, we're kind of moving towards a conversation around basic income, some form of guarantee for care leavers. As you'll know, there was the Scottish Basic Income Feasibility Study, which has recommended a basic income, and they were setting that at around £213.59 per week. This is a very specific and detailed question around this, because we're talking about an amount of money. And there are some who have, in these conversations that have been floating around for a number of years, around basic income. But there are some who would say that that is too much. And again, just would be really interested in your reflections on that. And to couple with that would be, would we need to be, what more might we need to do to support young people to adjust to that level of income?
And so I think the £213 figure is a 2018 figure, isn't it?
Yeah.
My query about that, and I haven't been involved in the detail of calculating what people believe to be the kind of generally right amount, but my first observation on that is, well, that's 3 years ago, so will it be enough is my question, not is it too much. You know, people have used pretty involved calculations to get to these figures. I would be sceptical that it was too much, in the same way that young folk were sceptical about whether or not it was unconditional. I would be sceptical if it was too much, to be honest, but I wasn't involved in the calculation. Well, I think we should anticipate that some young folk will spend on things they shouldn't. I know I did when I was 17 and 18. I've got a daughter of 25 and 23, one of 23. Sometimes they spend their money on things that probably, as a mother, I think, oh, I wish you'd stop spending your money on that. It's kind of a rite of passage as a teenager, isn't it, in that sense. So I don't think we should get too judgy-wudgy about it. I definitely think that we need to look at how we support any young person who's becoming independent to manage their budget. Gee whiz, if somebody had supported me on budgeting when I was 18, I might be better at it than I am now. So again, it's for me, it's about getting alongside young folk, just being really practical with them about splitting their money up, helping them understand where it goes, why they, you know, paying their rent, etc., or their living costs, whatever. But for me, once you've got the space and the headroom and you're involved in a trusted and trusting relationship with that young person, you know, you're able to do that. You won't be able to influence how young people spend their money if you're sniping at them and you're being punitive in terms of, or judgmental in terms of what they're doing and how they're doing it. So for me, the important thing is, yeah, absolutely, we need to offer folk guidance and support, but we need to do that within the context of a trusted and trusting relationship.
Sally-Anne, thank you for your time today. This has been a really useful and interesting conversation. And obviously there are a number of calls to action within that as well. And I think that is something that we have a shared ambition around, which is how we amplify some of the things that we've experienced on behalf of children, young people, families and care leavers. Is there anything that you would like to just reflect on before we bring this conversation around poverty to a close today?
The only thing I would say, Joe, is that, you know, we have the promise and the plan for the promise will be with us shortly. As a country, I know many, many organisations and people that have put forward a commitment to keep the promise. And the promise that we're keeping is on behalf of our children who have experienced the care system, who are maybe leaving the care system, and all of those children who rely on extra support, if you like, from the state at the moment, or families that rely on extra support that probably want to live an independent life free from that support where they can. We're at a really important time in the development of the promise because it's a year just now since the publication of the promise. And I think if we were being honest, then I don't think there's been any huge messages from government about the commitment to the promise. And I think we need to start to put a wee bit of pressure on government to state very clearly what they're going to do about all of the commitments that organisations across this country have made to keeping that promise and what their efforts are going to be in keeping the promise. And that includes a level of openness and transparency about money and how much money there is available to make change happen and how that money will be allocated, and a really firm commitment that this is not something that can be dealt with in 1 year or 2 years, but is something that we need to absolutely keep a focus on for at least the next 10 years as a country.
Thank you, Sally-Anne. And again, thank you for being a voice, for not being afraid to amplify that voice on behalf of those that you represent and support. And that includes those within around Aberlour, for staff and the broader aspects of Scottish society. Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Forum and it has given you some food for thought. If you want to learn more about staff and our work, head over to our website on www.staff.scot to find out about how you can become a member, participate in our focus groups and forums, and learn about our participation work with young people.